No idea, good or bad, is worth shelving without working it through. A lot of great ideas end up coming from bad ideas, so it's important to think about the approach and the attempt that's being made in that sort of design. And on the other side of the coin, you know, you also have to be very comfortable with killing your darlings.
What's better than a Third Floor Wars exclusive interview with Matt Carter and Kyle Rowan from Weird Games? They have just released Gaining Grounds Season 1, the first Malifaux 3rd Edition errata, and the first Malifaux 3rd Edition FAQ. Matt, Kyle, and I talk through all three of them. I think it's fascinating to find out really what their approach was. What were they thinking before they even stepped into it? How did they get started deciding what model should be part of the errata and which one should be left alone? How do they decide which rules needed some clarification in the FAQ? What are the new strategies and schemes that they created for Gaining Grounds Season 1? More importantly, why were they created and which ones did they get rid of? This is a packed episode. I recommend listening to it at least twice. Enjoy.
Playing a tabletop strategy game allows you to unplug and test your skills against friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars delivers useful strategies, discussions, battle reports, and reviews to tabletop games like Malifaux. If you want to get better at the games you already play, or discover the games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk Broadcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. Today we're talking with Matt Carter and Kyle Rowan from Weird Games. Now, our first guest is the game designer at Weird Games, Matt Carter. And Matt's been on the show before. If you have not listened to that episode, it came out around fall of last year, right when M3E dropped. And we got some incredible insights from Matt on kind of what their thoughts were on third edition. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes. Make sure you listen to it. It's a must listen as far as I'm concerned. So, Matt, welcome back to the Third Floor.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Yeah, man. So you have had nothing going on over the last 6 months, right? You haven't been busy or anything?
Nothing at all. Very, very boring.
I bet. So the last time you were on, we kind of got your history. We found out, you know, how you got into miniature gaming and things like that. I would be curious, though, is there any gaming you do outside of miniatures?
I still play a lot of board games whenever I get the chance, and mostly video games all the time. I've been playing CRPGs on my computer.
Oh, yeah? So. Nice. So can we ask what you've been playing recently?
The most recent game I've been playing is Pathfinder Kingmaker.
Nice.
A couple years ago. So.
Now, do you do any tabletop RPGs at all?
Right now, I'm in a 5th edition campaign. And then we occasionally play Through the Breach at the Office. So
very nice. Very nice. So my second guest is new to the show. He is the design lead at Weird Games, Kyle Rowan. This is Kyle's first time and hopefully not last time on the show. So, Kyle, welcome to the Third Floor.
Hello, everyone.
You're going to get the standard question, Kyle, because this is your first time on, which is how did you find miniature gaming and how did you eventually find Malifaux?
So it all kind of happened by a mistake. I was in Austin at the time looking for a board game, went to the local shop, caught a glimpse of, you know, the dark world of Malifaux in the corner of the store and had to know more, you know, who are those characters? What is this game? Started asking questions. Local henchman there helped me out quite a bit and, you know, scooped up the starter box, and that was that. I tried looking into that shop recently. I couldn't find the name. It might have even closed down. If anyone is in Austin, though, it was right by the Alamo Draft House down there.
Nice.
But a fine mustachioed gentleman down there helped me out. So if you're listening, thank you for getting me in the Malifaux.
So was that your first miniature game then, Kyle? First time playing a miniature war game?
Yeah, so I have kind of a history in video game design, and I played board games more as a hobby, and then, yeah, Malifaux was my introduction to minis games. I mean, I was aware of the other ones, but I hadn't played them firsthand. A lot of friends in my area would play some, and I would watch, but never firsthand experience it, so...
Gotcha. And have you played outside of Malifaux, or has that been your game exclusively as far as mini games go?
Since then, no. It's different when you're on the designer side. You want to look at the at other games, but from a more analytical approach. There are some hybrid board games that I do try to dip my toes in. Most recently, Kingdom Death I've been playing.
Nice.
And you could argue that that's, a miniatures game with a board game on top, cooperative. But for the most part, it's still tried and true Malifaux for me.
So a question, this is kind of for both of you, but we'll start with Kyle. How hard is it for you guys to take your designer hat off when you're playing another game? And I don't mean another mini game, but even a board game where you can actually just sit back and enjoy it. Or do you find yourself constantly, thinking about mechanics and thinking about stuff like that? Kyle, are you able to unplug as a designer and just play games?
No, for me, it's pretty much impossible. But it's kind of like, the second you, pretty much in any entertainment industry, I feel like it's the case. The second you see behind the curtain, the magic kind of disappears.
Yeah.
But it's just a different kind of magic back there, you end up realizing. And that's kind of why I fell into in love with design as a whole, is you just think about those games very differently. Yeah. Now, when I need an escape, I usually go into a book or a movie instead. But yeah, games these days are very much an analysis first, and I can't escape that.
Yeah, I can understand. How about you, Matt? Are you the same?
I'm a little bit different. If I am trying to like hardcore win a game playing competitively, then I'm going to think about it really analytically. But if I'm just trying to relax, I'll just kind of turn on the stupid switch and just forget about everything. And that's the only way I can really like not think about those issues.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, from a player perspective, that's what that Marvel game that I've been playing has been for me, is that, Malifaux is my passion. It's my love, obviously. And it's the best game out there, hands down. But it takes a lot, and which is part of why I love it, right? It takes, it's a deep game. It, the decisions you make matter more than any other game I've ever played, board game or minis game. So what's kind of nice to me it every once in a while is to pull out that Marvel game and play that, because I don't have to think. I can just sit back and enjoy and go pew pew and, and actually, have fun with it. But we're not here to talk about any of that. Let's start off, gentlemen. We are now several months since release with third edition. I would be curious to know, Matt, really, what are your thoughts about how things have been going for the past 8-9 months?
It's going great. all honest, we're really happy with everything that's kind of come forward. It's always something that you don't really know, especially going into a new edition, how people will see it. Sometimes people completely hate the new edition. Sometimes it goes off without a hitch, and granted, there have been a few small setbacks, but it's really amazing.
Well, and I get the impression, Matt, that the setbacks have nothing to do with game design, right? And things like that. Those have been setbacks that I think have been outside of that realm. And I think I cannot imagine how nerve-wracking, Kyle, it must have been to be sitting on this baby for as long as you guys did, and then finally let the world see the baby pictures and hope they don't think it's ugly. That must have been just incredibly nerve-wracking.
A little bit of nerves, a lot of excitement, and that's a feeling that you can't really describe, that weird blend between both of those. Mostly excitement, just like Matt said, we were blown away by the response once we finally got it out. We're on our third reprint of the core rules.
God, that's amazing.
That third reprint is already, on its way out. So we're looking at a fourth already. So, it's been huge for us. We're just super excited to move the game forward even more now.
So Kyle, out of curiosity, what's been the biggest surprise for you since release? The thing, what did you and Matt really did not see coming that's happened?
So there's been surprise after surprise. I guess the one that sticks out to me is how many people signed Cooper's contract. That was a different type of surprise. People should read the fine print a little bit more. That was a fun little experiment. But
that was fun.
Yeah. No, I mean, like every day we hop on the forums or in a weird place and there's some sort of reaction that's surprising us to some extent. So the Cooper moment is the one thing that I always go back to, though, mainly because we're working on that crew. So it's kind of the main conversation.
I'm sure. Matt, what has surprised you?
Very simply, the hat for our Jeep. How much that blew up. I've never in a million years thought that one stupid hat would make Archie be so prominent all of a sudden. And like, he's very good, as we'll talk about later.
Too. Yeah.
But like, people were just like, I want that hat.
Oh, as soon as I saw it, I called it. I'm like, this is the dumbest, best idea I've ever seen.
It happened. Matt just randomly said it in conversation as we were working on the idea of Black Tongue Bonnet. And it was one of those crazy ideas that you just toss out that had to happen. It just had to happen. Yeah. And then, you know, we further pushed that with Archie, you know, the ridiculousness of that on his card. So
now that was a good happenstance. It was I had a feeling it was either a beautiful mistake or ridiculously planned ahead. So it's good to see maybe it was a little bit of both, more mistake than anything. But so I'd be curious, Matt, you know, a lot of changes from 2 to 3. Matt, I know you listen to the podcast, so you've heard, you know, a lot of opinions about it. I'd be curious to know what changes you think have had the biggest or the best impact on the game.
Yeah. So I think I talked about it slightly before the last time we talked, but kind of the thematics of how building crews work and keywords.
Oh, yeah. That has been
so big for everything kind of we approach. And it's been one of the most positively received kind of feedback that we get. And it's really fun to design around like less individual models and more how can this benefit the crew as a whole. And so kind of all the changes that spread from that is massive. And it's a really big boon for third edition that I'm really excited we decided on.
Yeah, that was a good decision. How about you, Kyle?
No, more or less the same. We are as competitive as Malifaux is, we're also a character and story driven game. And we were really able to make those crews shine on the table as much as in their stories. We're able to create real strengths and weaknesses based on the situation with the keyword system. And, you know, we're seeing unique lists, which is what we wanted from the start. We didn't want to see the same characters popping up across all the factions and that sort of thing. So, the keyword system, without a doubt.
Yeah, and what I think I found, Kyle, is that it really did you ended up in the kind of the best of both worlds, where you took care of everybody's desire to be thematic and character driven, but quite frankly, it made things, I think, from a competitive standpoint, better. But it also, so there's certain things I consider like distinctly Malifaux. Things that I think make Malifaux different as a guy who's played more than a dozen different minis games. One of the things that I think makes Malifaux is the idea of a variable pool and the fact that we build and decide crew selection after knowing the variable win conditions. And boy, does that keyword system fit into that perfectly.
Yeah, I agree. And hopefully you're just going to see that getting highlighted even more and gaining grounds in season one. There are going to be strategies and schemes that are just better for one crew versus another. And, you know, that's okay. That's kind of the what makes Malifaux special is that one day you can put Terra out, and the next day you're going to need to put Levy out, or, you know, Jackdaw, or maybe if you're not an outcast player, go somewhere else. But
So you don't want to hear my thoughts on Outcast. So the reason I have both of these gentlemen on the podcast is either is just about to be released or it's going to be released soon. We're going to be seeing some new information. We're going to be getting Gaining Ground Season 1, our first FAQ for 3rd edition, and our first errata for 3rd edition. And I really, you know, I want to understand not what changed, because we can all read the documents when they're in our hands and do it. What I really want to get an understanding from these gentlemen is, you know, what was the design decisions made? What was driving what we ended up with after these things have been released? So if it's okay with you guys, I'd like to start with Gaining Ground Season 1 and kind of touch on a few things. One, I would like to talk about the terrain and how terrain has been laid out and defined there. So Kyle, can you give us an idea of what the thinking is behind the terrain section of Gaining Grounds 1?
Well, I mean, just existing in the document was pretty new in comparison to someone who's coming from second edition. The way we see Gaining Grounds, though, is that it's essentially a tool for both experienced tournament organizers, event organizers, and newcomers who want to build those events. We want it to feel like a toolbox and a resource. The amount of terrain on a table makes such a huge impact in Malifaux. So we wanted to make sure that it wasn't an easy thing to overlook. You know, sight lines break certain crews for better or worse. We just wanted to make sure that anyone who's not familiar with putting a table together to have these ground rules that they can reference. Now, comparatively to season zero, we have learned a few things. We've gotten some feedback, so we are making some changes in that section. They aren't huge, but sometimes a little change makes a big impact.
Yeah, what's funny about that, Kyle, is you talk about things you don't anticipate. Gaining Ground Zero came out. I read through it and I looked at it, and I think you guys gave it to me a day or two before it was released to everybody. And I read the train section. I'm like, okay, that's cool. And I kept going. I had no idea that you would be starting the revolution with the guidelines that you put in there. And boy, you guys had a great little joke on a Waldo's Weekly about it, which I thought was fantastic. Matt, anything outside of what Kyle talked about that you think is significant about terrain for Malifaux in general or for Gaining Grounds 1?
Yeah, one of the things that we talk about is just how to set up like choke points and kind of lanes, which is really important to how mobility works for Malifaux in general. Getting around the table is pretty key to winning. And one of the things that was an idea that we were just like, how do we make sure that this works? Is just put a 50 mil base on the table, make sure people can walk through that, because that's the biggest size base that you're going to really see. And having the ability to move through a gap is very important. Granted, you don't have to have 250 mils fit through anything, but the ability to like Euripides move from one place to another is pretty important.
Yeah.
And so just setting those guidelines so that even players that have never put a table together before can see like, okay, I can put like a lot of terrain, but kind of leave these small gaps. And we think it just makes the game better from just a terrain standpoint.
Yeah, and I think it's an elegant decision too, because it simplifies things. I mean, the terrain section in Gaining Grounds 1 is small, and it's very to the point, and I think it's simplified. So I agree. So Matt, let's move over to kind of the game variants. I'd like to hear kind of your thoughts on that section.
Yeah, so game variants are the idea that every meta that's out there, from just our local meta to even South Carolina to across the pond in England, like everyone plays the game very differently. And we didn't want to limit any individual meta from playing a specific way by saying you have to play with Duel Masters or you have to play with Dead Man's Hand or any of these other things. And so giving people the choice behind the matter and saying like, whatever you want to do with these is fine. Locally, like when we run tournaments, we plan on using them just as much as anyone else, some less than others, because some make for crazier tournaments.
Right. Kyle, what were your thoughts as far as game variants?
No, Matt and I are more or less on the same page. You know, some people include Dead Man's Hand Masters, others don't. Some allow multiple masters, others don't. And, you know, neither decisions, neither are wrong. Yeah. We're in the business of, we're not in the business of telling people how to play, Malifaux. We're making in the business of making sure that people are having fun, you know. On top of that, we also added other ways players can enjoy the game that they might not have thought of, you know, ban lists, too many secrets, those sorts of things just add a little bit of spice to the game. That just, yeah, the second you start getting bored of the standard, you could try something a little bit differently.
Yeah, I agree. Now, here's the question for you, Kyle. Not necessarily which one do you think is the best, but what is the game variant that you get the most excited about?
It's going to sound wrong, but ban lists, really.
Yeah.
I know that sounds ridiculous, but it makes crew building that much more important. It makes, you know, suddenly you're playing a McMorning crew. You really want to put him on the table. It might not be the easiest thing to plan for your opponent, and making it that much more difficult, I think, is an interesting choice. And it's just, you know, if it doesn't work for your community, but it works in ours, you know, that's fine. You know, we know people have strong opinions on ban lists, so I don't want to step on anyone's toes with that one. But
well, yeah, I mean, it's what gets you excited, right, Matt?
Sure.
Yeah. So personally, when I like play like from a casual or competitive play, I want to play like I think we put in it's called limited. Of just like ban format with fixed lists and vanilla, so no upgrades. That to me is how like I really enjoy playing. It's a bit simpler, but a way more hardcore in terms of like I need to know the fundamentals of the game to
right.
proceed. I can't necessarily put an upgrade on something and know that it's always going to be there and that I don't want to call it crutch, but like have that extra aspect. And so utilizing different formats to play in better ways, like bans, I think is great for competitive, just in general. The ability to say, like, I'm playing McMorning, man, I really don't want to see like that one piece of condition removal that's going to completely shut me down. I can say, like, no, I don't want to see that. Or if you're allowing dual masters, you can say, like, hey, I don't want to see Zoraida as a second master anyway. I can ban that Swamp Fiend keyword. I don't have to deal with that, and I can plan around that. And that gives you a bit more freedom. But it lets you play the crew that you want to play without worrying that everything's going to kind of hammer down on you. So
I'm real anxious to see which of these variants start seeing a little bit more play. Granted, I don't talk to everybody that runs tournaments, but I get a chance to connect with a lot of people that do. And I'm not hearing a lot of the variants being used, even though as far as USFO Tour is concerned, we allow it. I'll be very interested to see if and when we see some of these, for lack of a better word, non-standard variants go in there. I've been talking with Ray and some other people about potentially making the Third Floor Wars U.S. Masters in October a banned list, because, Matt, I agree with you. I think Kyle, I think you mentioned banned. I think that's a really interesting format, especially for the ultra-competitive meta knowledge players, which hopefully, you know, we would see at Masters. So other things that we're going to see in Gaining Grounds 1 is some new strategies. So Kyle, do you want to kind of give us an idea of what we can look forward to there?
I guess starting off, we can talk about bringing back a fan favorite. Symbols of Authority will be coming back. We're giving it a bit of a facelift to make sure that it works the way we want it to in third edition, but it's essentially going to play very similarly to what people remember. People love it. You know, we love it. I thought it was a good time to bring it back.
And from a design perspective, Kyle, like what drove that for you? Was it just saying, hey, this was an oldie but a goodie, let's give it a facelift? Or was there kind of a bigger thought process behind bringing back Symbols?
So that's a larger question than just specifically Symbols of Authority. It's kind of the approach we took with Gaining Ground Season 1 as a whole. We wanted to touch base on familiarity, but also making sure that the game was fresh. And that's a kind of a delicate balance, but we wanted to make sure that Gaining Ground Season 1 had some punch to it. So to have that punch, though, you did need to kind of hit the comfort zones a little bit. And luckily, Symbols of Authority was just kind of this the spot where we already knew it worked well, people loved it, and it just seemed like the right time for it.
Yeah, that's a tough balance, Kyle. Matt, how did you guys navigate that balance?
Primarily, it's kind of looking at each of the four strategies and all the schemes coming along and making sure that any sort of list can play in certain places. So you're not having a master that's completely just out of the meta for a year, and that Symbols has different goals and kind of design intention than, say, the rest of them we'll get to. And letting you kind of play in different ways was really important. So they were not just like, all of these are kill focused. But in terms of like Symbols specifically, one of the things that changed was just how we approach scoring victory points in third edition. With the core rules, we really approached a sort of exponential growth of victory points. And we still like that concept of saying things get harder as we go along. Symbols was one of those that, because there are less of these markers, it kind of naturally leans itself towards that anyway. And you have to keep doing it every turn. That's the really important part for a lot of these, is the idea of continual use. So you can't just say, set it and forget it, like some of the old things. So,
yeah, and it doesn't happen as incidentals either. So like another thing that I noticed about Symbols in particular is, I mean, to a certain degree, there's some strategies. I mean, you saw it a little bit in Turf War, you see it in Reckoning, where I'm going to be killing things anyway. So if I end up scoring, that's great. Whereas it seems like you have to be more intentional to score something like Symbols.
Yeah.
So after Symbols, Matt, what is the one do you think people are going to notice?
So we already talked about this next one with Waldo's Weekly that came out, 2 days ago? Recover Evidence. So that's one of the brand new strategies for GG1. And it kind of takes the idea of you having to defend your own resources while also fighting back against your opponent. And it's really exciting. We're super happy for it. It puts a bit more kill focus back in the game. So Symbols, you don't have to kill your opponent. Obviously, it's going to be very good. Recover Evidence, you do have to fight against your opponent. Now, we're always working to change things. So the Recover Evidence that was shown off 2 days ago might not be exactly what shows up in Gaining Grounds 1, because that even that small bit of feedback that we get from a larger community than just our playtesters shows us a lot. So the ability to say, like, adjusting it down so it's slightly easier to get across, but maybe the markers are slightly put out in a minute way that's slightly different, that it allows us to do things a little bit differently. So Recover Evidence, of instead of saying like kill, of just saying like, hey, if you get them to 1 HP, like that is enough difference that saying like hard to kill is a big mechanic of the game.
Yeah.
But if you can hit that mark, then you can keep them around, and then you can do anything you want once they're still there and they're at really low HP. So that idea of just saying like, you're at low HP, please stay here while I like deliver a message or whatever I else want to do to you.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And it's got to be, it's got to happen over and over again, Kyle. I would imagine that, you know, this you make a small adjustment and there's a huge ripple effect in a way that you almost can't anticipate, that you just have to kind of get crowdsourced, I would imagine.
Within versus completely within. No, there's 100 little things that we have to be aware of when making those minute little details.
Yeah.
Recover Evidence is a good example of it. But ultimately, we wanted to come out with, you know, a theme-heavy strategy, you know, tells a story via gameplay. I think we accomplished that. Hopefully, people aren't going to be twiddling their thumbs on each side of the table till one of them wins. We wanted to make sure that wasn't the kind of a thing. And that was we saw some of the flaws in previous strategies of previous editions that had those sorts of issues, where you were playing different games, and that was a major focus of us for Gaining Grounds season one as a whole, too. Make sure that interaction happened.
Well, and the change that you guys made in third edition to really make the strategy matter more, just by the adjustment of only 2 points per scheme versus three, it puts a little bit more weight on the design decisions you make for the strategies.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you're gonna see that with strategies versus schemes in Gaining Ground season one. there's definitely a focus on the strategies for sure. Schemes are still important. They're going to probably be a little bit more challenging to get off, but that's okay. You know, we do want people to kind of think differently about the way these strats and scenes are going to play out on the table.
The idea of the changing how points work with four points for the strat and 4 points for schemes, that is one of the kind of pivotal points that we think has changed a lot of how the minutia of the game changes, and had a huge impact on kind of everything. And so we were just talking about that yesterday of really the difference between like us sharing something and that's worth half as much as our kind of secret objectives. Let the game not feel like we can just win by playing with ourselves.
Yeah, it was a huge change, a bigger change than I realized when I first saw it. Right, when I first saw third edition and saw that that's how things were changing. It wasn't until probably my 10th game of third edition did I realize and just how overarching the impact change was.
Yeah, with second edition, you could occasionally just like ignore the strategy and be like, I'm going to get 1 point from this, and that's all I really care about. But with third, you have to pay attention to these kind of interactive moments between the players. Otherwise, you are going to fall behind. And how it's scoring every turn, you can't just sit on your heels and do something all at once. You have to continuously work towards your goals. And it makes for a better game.
I agree. I think thematically, one of the biggest things that I ended up liking the most about third edition is you have to deal with your opponent more in third edition than you did in second edition. You don't have the option that you did sometimes in second edition to just sit back to your point. Kyle, how about Corrupted Ley Lines? Can you give us an idea of what the thinking was there?
So we have an interesting story about Corrupted Ley Lines.
Okay.
So that one started off, the best way I could probably describe it is a heated debate. You know, we both had similar ideas in the design room. We thought we were on the same page. That turns out it wasn't the case. Went to the playtesting room, visually show off what we were all talking about. And now, you know, neither of those ideas are even in the game.
Isn't that funny?
Both have evolved since then. But the core aspects of them are still in there. Basically, we took one idea and made Corrupted Ley Lines and the other idea into Runic Binding, which is one of the upcoming schemes. But Corrupted Ley Lines is another one that tells, you know, another great story. We have a world where the magic is often in the stuff in the ground. You know, the ley lines are connecting everything. And what happens when some of that gets corrupted? You know, someone's got to clean it up. And so the concept, though, was essentially, what are these ley lines? How could we define them on the table? And the wild idea was that, you know, what if we did something like magic meets circuitry, which kind of combines two major themes in Malifaux. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how we hope it is going to be played on the table and viewed on the table. We've got some players and playtesters currently who loathe it, and some who are currently having trouble understanding it. It is a large, a lot of text on that card. But we're also seeing that, you know, some players are telling us it's the best game of Malifaux that they had in years. So we do expect that one to be polarizing. I personally am a huge fan of it. I think that it gets players into the opposite side of the table very quickly, and you're going to be interacting all over the place constantly. And I think that's something that drives the strat as a whole.
So, question for you, Matt. How, you know, Kyle kind of talked about, you know, kind of a thematic, and for lack of a better word, fluffy a thought as far as that. When you guys are coming up, I mean, there's two ways to look at anything in the game, but let's focus on strategies. There's, you know, you've got kind of the fluffy, the feel you want for the strategy, and then you've got the, you know, the core mechanics. Which comes first? Does one come first always, or does it change sometimes?
Both. So it's like Corrupted Ley Lines was the idea of we really wanted to push like teamwork, saying like this, a model cannot do this by themselves.
Right.
All the other strategies, you can you can go and have one model technically do that by itself. It's probably very, very hard, where Corrupted Leylines, it absolutely requires multiple models and really putting the idea of teamwork into play. And that was one thing that pushed it. And thematically, it just came about the idea of like that circuit board and drawing geometric shapes, which we thought was really, really cool. And they were two separate ideas to start with, and they kind of merged together. So it really depends where the kind of thought process comes from. Of if we want to start thematically, it might just be a name of something or how it works. And then we just kind of go along from there. So even working on models, I might say like, oh, I really like how this sounds on this card, or I want to reference this one thing. How can I make this play into mechanically what I want that to do? And Corrupted Leylines is just one of those that has that weird origin of circuit boards.
That's cool.
I thought it was fun. So,
So, Matt, talk to me about Public Enemies, which is the one that I found extremely interesting.
Yeah, Public Enemies is for GG. It's like the reckoning of season one. It's to push the idea of sometimes you just want to kill things. It's fun, but you can't making the idea of just kill everyone is not really in the Malifaux way. So how do we adjust it to make it as interesting as possible while relying on really tactical decision making.
So Public Enemies kind of took a symbols of authority like approach in that we were looking at old strats and ways of reinventing them. So Public Enemies is actually the natural progression of an older one called Collect the Bounty.
Yep.
So that one was based off of, you know, peons, minions, and so forth. That didn't work as cleanly anymore with third edition, but leaning into the cost of a model, I thought was the best approach that we can take while making that sort of strat feel right for the latest version of the game. And I think we had a sweet spot with it.
So here's what I found that was interesting about it. So there's one of the things I liked about Reckoning, and I like about any strategy or any pool, is I want it to impact my decisions in crew building, and not only from a keyword perspective, but literally what models I bring into the crew. And what I think was something that the metas figured out pretty quickly was the idea of how many Reckoning points am I making available when I play Reckoning. You would have to have a serious thought behind bringing a henchman in or a second master in because of how Reckoning worked. What I like about Public Enemies is you guys turned the volume up on that, where it's not just, you know, do I bring a henchman or not, or a second master or not, but the cost of the model. So I think what Matt said was right, which is a very nice natural progression. So well done on that, guys. It was maybe at surface not the most interesting one, but it was the one that really caught my eye. So guys, what I want to do is take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to keep talking about Gaining Ground Season 1 and touch on some of the schemes that we're going to see there. So we'll be right back.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Howdy friends, Greg here. Nothing makes Malifaux easier than having the right tools. Here at the Third Floor, we love all the licensed Malifaux goodies from Custom Meeple. Not only are they helping support this podcast, they sell custom-made weird licensed tokens and terrain. They sell it all. crew boxes, terrain, markers, tokens, and even a 3x3 full Malifaux board. Custom Meeple sells a complete M3E token set covering every marker and token you need to play. Custom Meeple are the source for the official accessories for Malifaux. Everything is designed by hand and authorized by Weird Games. Check them out at CustomMeeple.com, that's with one M, or follow the link in the show notes. Up your Malifaux game and be sure to tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. If you use the promo code ThirdFloorFriend, all one word, ThirdFloorFriend, you'll get a 5% discount and help support the podcast. It's valid on everything except retail products and playmats. Gaining Grounds 1 not only gives us some new strategies, but it also gets some new schemes for us. And so, but Kyle, before we kind of go over some of the new schemes and how schemes changed, I'd like to get an idea from a design perspective. So before anybody in the office sat down and created anything new or changed anything from a scheme perspective, what were some of the goals that you guys set out for that process?
Again, with just like with the strategies like Symbols of Authority and Public Enemies, you know, familiarity is important, but so is giving new ways of playing the game. So we had to make sure that we met both of those goals. That was especially important for us for Season 1, being that this is, you know, the first major Gaining Grounds. You know, and you might look at some of these schemes right now and think they might sound more difficult than they actually are. As I said earlier, some are that way, and that's fine. There's one in particular that comes to mind that reads as basically impossible, but it's not. You read it and you think there's no way I'm getting this done. You start realizing that, you know, ice pillars work, pyre markers work, and suddenly you're thinking outside the box of how to score points. And all of a sudden, underplayed crews are being given new life that way. And that's kind of the third major thing that we wanted to hit with Gaining Ground Season 1, is making sure that new crews were being considered to get these points scored. Breathing life into crews that are being a little underplayed right now that we think are just as interesting, but might have had some challenges in Season 0.
Well, that's one thing that's great about the game in general and the Gaining Grounds concept. So, Matt, I'd be curious from a design perspective, how often are you guys worried about what I call dead schemes, which are schemes that when they end up in the pool, they just don't seem to be taken very often? How much of that is being thought of in this process?
We don't want that. It is a bad thing. But we do try to make it so sometimes the strategy will just not work with what you want to do with this certain stream. So it will happen, or you declared your keyword in your master and you're just like, look, there's no way I'm getting this scheme. And that's okay. As long as each of them kind of has a place in the world and can be chosen in different circumstances and allow for different types of play. So if you're really wanting to play Colette and you're like, I don't necessarily want to take the duet or kill people, there's still the idea of like, there's a bunch of schemes you can do that don't require you to kill people. So the idea of dead schemes, like, it happens. We want to avoid it as much as possible, but it's the most important thing is that they still have a role within Gaining Grounds, and people will take them at specific points. Some might be taken more than others, and that's okay.
So, Matt, out of curiosity, do you think that there's one either change scheme or new scheme that you think is going to get the most attention at first, that we're going to hear the most about?
There are some of the new schemes that are different, like Kyle was just saying. Research mission, for example, like there are some crews that just don't really want to take research mission. It requires different types of markers. There are some crews that would love to take research mission of just being like, yeah, I can put out an ice marker, a scheme, and literally anything else and be just fine. If you don't have some sort of aspect to play that, it's not really worth taking, and I wouldn't recommend it. But the crews that can take it, it does allow a new avenue of them playing. And so that idea of, here, we're going to talk about markers, which is a style of game, like a core mechanic of the game that we don't really talk about that much in terms of scoring in general. We talk about ski markers and course markers a lot, but just the idea of like, hey, we have a bunch of terrain markers in third edition. How can we make those as interesting and impactful as possible with just scoring points?
Yeah, the first time you read Research Mission, or I'll speak for myself, the first time I read Research Mission, it did not hit me that it didn't specify ski markers. I just assumed it in my head. Then I read it the second time and I went, oh, this is a lot more interesting than I thought. it'll be interesting to see, because I think it's going to hit on what you talked about, Kyle, which is let's get some other keywords in play and let's use things that are already in the game a little bit differently. So Kyle, for you, what's the scheme that you're either most excited about or you think is going to get a lot of chatter or attention?
Runic Binding, which we kind of already touched upon, it being the natural evolution of two different ideas. I think it's a really interesting scheme. Again, players will be thinking about the game a little bit differently, containing their opponents in an interesting way. Sabotage will be fun for players. Sabotage was interesting for us because it started off as thinking about Search the Ruins in a different light. Uh-huh. And you kind of get it started off as like the inverse of that, and it's evolved since then. But I think that that's going to be another popular one. Those two in particular have me excited.
And I haven't played Sabotage yet, but I can't wait to, because I think what's going to be interesting with Sabotage is how defending it and denying it evolves over time.
Right.
It's going to be very, very interesting to see how that unfolds.
One of the ideas that we wanted to approach with schemes in general, GG1 and the core rules, like you could kind of get away with interacting with the schemes by yourself and adding players the opportunity to deny you. While it might not be as popular among our players, the idea of, well, this is not the most consistent points ever, it does make for a way more interesting game to say, like, I might not be able to score my point, but if I can deny you a turn, that is going to be very beneficial. It could also completely blow up in your face. It's happened to me in one of our playtest games. I was playing Sabotage and I was like, oh, I can try to deny him a point by removing one of these markers. And I was like, nope, I just lost a point. And that caused me to completely lose the game. And so having the idea to give yourself those decision points of saying, like, I can walk over there and potentially stop him if I know what he's doing. But it also says, like, I can bluff. Like, putting one of these that is really interesting is spread them out, which is just having markers far away from each other. It's really easy to bluff just other schemes because those are just ski markers. As soon as they're on your opponent's half of the table, they're good for you. And if you're trying to do specific stuff, you can set up your opponents in really interesting ways, and it just gives more ideas to, like, secrets and scheming and all these back end, like, thievy kind of stuff that's really, really fun.
I gotta say to both of you, I love how much the fluffiness comes through in your thinking, because it I think it would be very easy in your job to think just mechanically, and I gotta tell you, I love that you guys keep that in mind. So Kyle, looking at this overall, the schemes that are in Gaining Grounds 1, I'm trying to think of the best way to put this. Which one do you consider a fix, where you think that you kind of fixed something that was not necessarily broken before, or made it maybe, how about upgrade? Which one do you consider an upgrade?
I don't know if I could specifically say that one in particular does that. I do think that the approach taken with schemes and strats as a whole will softly fix crew choices. We are going to see a little bit more aggression, a little bit more interaction heavy crews this time around. And as Matt even said, you know, that was an approach that we consciously made. Aggression is a factor this time around, and we want to highlight that. And you're going to see that in just about all of them to some extent, whether directly or indirectly.
I can hear the guild players cheering.
Craig, you asked the question of, like, upgrade. What is a scheme that is different than something before? Like, we have Hidden Martyrs, which is kind of like, well, what's the old scheme of getting your guys killed?
Frame for Murder.
Yeah, we have Hidden Martyrs, which is kind of like Frame for Murder, but Frame for Murder was kind of awful to play against, because once you kill that person, it doesn't feel good from your opponent's perspective. And so making Hidden Martyrs, we wanted to say, like, we really liked the concept behind Frame for Murder, and like, get your dude killed is a very Malifaux thing. And so taking that and changing it up so that once one of those guys dies, the other one has to get out of dodge and be tankier, is saying, like, you can't just put it on your two weakest dudes or your two guys that you know are going to get killed, because one of them has to live and they both have to be fairly small.
Yep.
So that was one of those that we looked back at the old Frame for Murder, and we were like, how can we make this fun for both players, but keep that idea of let's go get people killed, because it's fun to have sacrifices in the middle of the table.
Yeah. Now, I might be putting my foot in my mouth here, because maybe this was your baby, but Kyle, one of my least favorite historical scheme or strategies was supply wagons. But
it's another polarizing one.
Yeah. And again, I'm you know, giving crap about it. It's going to end up being your favorite thing in the world, what you watch. But, the one thing I liked about it, I've talked about it on the podcast before. The one thing I really liked about it is how much it changed crew building. And it sounds like that was really turned out to be an overall goal for you guys walking into Gaining Grounds 1, was not just create a strategy or a scheme that's going to impact it, but it sounds like that was something that you wanted to happen all over the place. Does that sound right?
I mean, even beyond Gaining Grounds, that was a conscious approach to third edition. You know, like, that's the keyword system in essence. You know, we want to highlight crew building. We want to hit those themes. We want... sometimes we want players to choose Molly versus Von Stuck based on the situation. Absolutely. We want players to be thinking outside the box. We don't want players to be constantly putting the same list on the table at the same time, every single time. That stagnates gameplay and interest. And we want players to bring in the unique models that are going to highlight certain strats and schemes. That's you're going to see that in just about every major decision that we make in third edition.
So out of curiosity, Kyle, the keyword system, going back to that real quick, do you think as a designer, the keyword system makes your job easier or harder?
I would say it makes things a little bit easier. The mercenary problem isn't nearly as problematic. The problem does get shifted a little bit with the versatile stuff. I would say overall it does make it easier. It allows us to create strengths and weaknesses in a way that wasn't really visibly apparent in previous crew building. So yeah, no, I would say that it makes things easier overall. It makes things more interesting at the very least.
Yeah, I bet.
Being able to make Molly feel very different than, you know, Yan Lo, and the sort of things that each player or each character can do.
Matt, how about for you? Is there something about the keyword system that you think, what's the biggest challenge from a design perspective with the keyword system?
Sometimes, like, I can't necessarily point out a specific, like, biggest challenge. Each thing kind of comes with its own hurdles. Sometimes it's just designing a new model, putting it in a keyword. It's really easy to say, like, oh, I want to do this thing. How does it approach everything else? But sometimes it's just as easy to say, like, okay, we have these limitations of, say, like, we want Molly to deal with, like, forgotten undead. What can we kind of put in that section that makes her feel fun and is a new concept? But in general, like, one of the things that you'll notice with the errata is there's not huge overarching changes to keywords, and that is because of how we approached, like, keyword abilities of saying this exists on everything. If we want to change that, it now has to change on everything, which is sort of this escalating scale of how much is being changed. So it becomes a little bit hard to adjust whole keywords at a time.
Right.
but that's not still out of the realm of possibility. So if we want to do that, we absolutely can. But like this Erato right now is focused on individual models. So not a lot of keyword abilities were being touched because it's a bit harder to adjust those while keeping the idea of like, yep, this is this on and on and on.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. So, guys, let's take another break. When we get back from the break, we're going to get into some more controversial topics. I want to talk to you about the FAQ. So we'll be right back. Howdy, friends. Here on the third floor, you'll find us playing Malifaux and other games on Mats by Mars. They are scratch-resistant, waterproof, wet erase marker compatible, and lighter than neoprene. Mats by Mars gives you over 40 designs to choose from. Pick a mat size, pick a design, then choose an overlay like the one for Marvel Crisis Protocol or Malifaux 3rd Edition. It will speed up deployment and the placement of strategy and objective markers. If you're going to Adepticon this year, be sure to check out the Mats by Mars booth. Until the end of March 2020, you can use the new promo code THIRDFLOOR320, that's THIRDFLOOR320, to get a 10% discount on your next order. In the notes, you can ask for the Third Floor logo to be put on your mat for free. Again, use the promo code THIRDFLOOR320 to get a 10% discount. Details are in the show notes. So, on the list of things that are going to cause a stir, obviously Gaining Grounds 1 will cause a stir and have the most obvious impact on the game overall. But the things that are going to cause the most noise and probably get a lot of the attention is the FAQ. And then we're going to talk about the errata a little bit later. But let's talk about the FAQ. And I don't feel the need, guys, because everybody can read it to, go line by line through it. But I would be curious, Kyle. How do you decide what you're going to put in the first FAQ?
Well, you'll see that this one is fairly large. There are going to be a lot of questions that we felt that deserved answering. But essentially, our focus was re-hitting the stuff that's already in the rule book that could be misconstrued or misunderstood, and making sure that people understood the original intent of the rules as written. And that was mainly the focus. There's a lot of interactions and timing in the game and those sorts of questions. And basically we went through and looked at all the most commonly asked questions and tried to address as many of those as possible.
And how often did you find in the FAQ that you were really making a change? Did you find that everything in the FAQ is more of a clarification to clarify what the intention was? Or do you feel like there was some actual decisions changed in the FAQ?
I mean, it's a little bit of both. I'd say mostly it's clarification stuff, but sometimes we just have to answer stuff that could be read one way or another. So it's a bit of a blend of both.
Matt, what do you think? What was the biggest surprise for you? What were some questions that came out soon after, third edition started getting play? What were some things people were not understanding that maybe surprised you?
It's hard to say. I can't think of a specific thing, but there's the general idea of sequential effects and how those work. And the idea is just if you have the your models, like the person with initiative does all of their things, the other player does all their things, and then the person with initiative resolves anything else left standing. That actually solves most of the issues that people have questions about, is just, yep, how does it work? Probably sequential effects. It's very important to know how that rule works, and it is pretty open for players to do the best possible thing. So like, recently I saw the question of like, can I use shielded to prevent burning? Yep, absolutely. It's just knowing how that timing sequential effects works is very important to why we might not have actually answered something of just saying like, look at this one paragraph. It's very, very important.
Well, I can tell you what kind of my perspective on this is. I think that structurally, 3 is much easier to understand than 2 for new players. I think it's harder for veterans of 2 because we thought a certain way, the idea of nested actions and things like that. And I think most of the questions that I see thrown out there are from people with a, what I call a 2E hangover, which is they're allowing how things worked in 2 to influence how 3 happens. And Kyle, from a design perspective, when you guys went into 3, how often does that happen to you as a designer where you catch yourself realizing, you know, hey, wait a minute, no, we changed that. That's not how it works anymore. Or are you guys so far deep into 3 at this point that there's really no 2E hangover from a design perspective?
It's less of a second to third edition from a design perspective. It's more, we made this change in this model yesterday. We made a different adjustment today. What is it? Where did we end up landing? That happens on a nearly daily basis for me, especially when we're working on new characters, you know, and balancing and creating new concepts and that sort of stuff. Sometimes I think that, you know, that last exciting, crazy idea ended up sticking around. And then Matt reminds me of, no, that remember that broken thing that happened? Oh, right. Yeah, let's move on.
Yeah, I don't know how you keep it in your head. I really don't. But that kind of leads me to another question, which is, and let's isolate it to the two of you. You guys, a lot of times, have to agree, right? So, Kyle, you have an idea. Matt goes, wow, what a great idea. And Matt has an idea, and you go, Kyle says, yeah, that's great. But there's got to be times where Matt has an idea, and Kyle, you go, wow, that might be the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. I'd be curious, and I'd like to hear from both of you, how do you guys work through that as designers, where you try to figure out and evaluate each other's ideas?
Well, me personally, Matt has heard me say it 100 times over. No idea, good or bad, is worth shelving without working it through. A lot of great ideas end up coming from bad ideas. So it's important to think about the approach and the attempt that's being made in that sort of design. And on the other side of the coin, you know, you also have to be very comfortable with killing your darlings. The thing that you really love, that you really want to put in, sometimes it's okay to, you know, throw it away or shelve it and use it for something else for when it's really important. Those sorts of conversations happen on a daily basis, but luckily Matt and I have found a system where we can work out the good and bad. It's a really collaborative room, and we try to make sure that those ideas, both good and bad, end up being explored.
So, Matt, out of curiosity, how would you describe that system Kyle's talking about to somebody who is outside of the room?
Well, I can't lie and say that there is yelling. Occasionally it happens. So it does help that we have another designer, Matt. We can always kind of turn to him and be like, all right, talk us through, what are your opinions? And sometimes he will side with one of us and then we kind of move on. It also helps a lot. Generally Kyle and I find that if we're disagreeing on something, to just take in what we each other are saying, and then step away for a couple minutes and think about it by yourself. Because oftentimes I'll find that if we're disagreeing about how something works and Kyle will throw an idea my way and I don't necessarily like it, or we both have an idea, stepping away and thinking about it 10 minutes later, not necessarily in the heat of like whatever we're talking about, and kind of melding the two ideas, that's always going to be the best thing that comes out. It's rarely ever that an idea is exactly what one of us wanted to do. So like earlier we talked about corrupted ley lines. Like it was not quiet in our office that day. It involved a lot of us going into our playtest room and physically placing markers on the table to try to explain it to each other. And then eventually the next day we both kind of were just like, oh, it should probably work this way. Because we both had thought about it, we both kind of came to these conclusions, and then we took that idea that didn't necessarily work as a strategy and made it that scheme, runic binding, and that played out in its own way by not having it to be forced over every single turn. And so, always kind of melding ideas and just taking a minute to think about it internally without saying anything can be very, very helpful, and also a third person.
Yeah. So, Kyle, out of curiosity, I think one of the challenges that I have as a player, and I think that we see this demonstrated a lot of times on the forums and in Weird Place, is what I call a sampling error. So, for example, and the example I'll give you is the first time I went up against the Pigapult. First time I went up against the Pigapult, I thought it was the most broken, dumbest thing I'd ever seen in Malifaux. Then I went home and thought about it a little bit more and went, oh, you know what? There's a lot I could have done. There's ways around this, and it seemed impenetrable to me. But and you'll see that in posts on the forums and in Weird Place sometimes, where people will say this is the dumbest thing ever, and it's because they saw it once with a bad combination, it was a bad matchup, and they went through it. What I'd be curious to know is, how do you battle that as a designer, where you don't allow one playtest game to put you in a position? I mean, how do you get through that?
That is a question that we try to address on a daily basis. Sometimes it is the case where that one playtest ends up shaping a decision. More often than not, though, we do need to look at a large sample. We need to consciously be aware of the strengths and weaknesses of a given model, like in the Pigapult, for example. But we want to make sure that characters feel powerful on the table.
Yep.
But on the other side of that coin, though, we do want to make sure that there are weaknesses. In some cases, there are going to be oversights on our part, and that's why we do playtests instead of just dumping out all these ideas out into final form right off the bat. We do lean on our playtesters quite a bit. We appreciate them to the point where we ourselves cannot express it. There are so many characters in our game. There are so many variables, and it doesn't matter how many games we play internally. We need to see it all as often as possible. So,
well, and I'm going to throw something out for the audience too, because a phrase that I hear often that kind of sets me off a little bit is, you know, how did this make it out of playtest? People will say, and the reason that triggers me is because I work in development, and you know, people will go, you know, how did QA let that happen? And what people don't understand is that, you know, there's things that you discover after two playtests internal, right? And then there's things you'll discover after 100 playtesters play 100 games. And then there's things that you're going to find after 10,000 games. But you wouldn't have found that in the first 1,000. And I think it's something for people that are listening to keep in mind, is that, you know, what we love about Malifaux is how intricate it is, and how there's so many ways to enjoy and win at this game that, you know, part of it is that there's going to be stuff that sneaks out that we have to work through. And then the second part of that is, you know, think about it before you decide, you know, just how busted things are. So, guys, let's take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I do want to talk about the errata, which really kind of ties in to what we were just talking about. So let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Alexander Zdenchuk from Riga, Latvia, and I'm a patron of Third Floor Wars. Those guys open the beauty of Malifaux 3rd edition to me and continue to provide tons of great content. You can support them too. Follow the links in the show notes below or search for Third Floor Wars at patreon.com.
So how much are three or four of these episodes worth to you a month? Third Floor Wars has a Patreon, and if you think they're worth a dollar, $5, $20 a month, swing by and become a patron. We have polls to decide the next episode of the pod, along with early releases of articles and podcasts. Everything we release goes out to everyone, but sometimes our patrons get a head start. The link is in the show notes, or just search for Third Floor Wars on Patreon.com. Thanks for the support. Wow, did we get an influx of patrons. I want to give a special thanks to Florian, Carl Lee, Jeff Mansker, Nathan Linder, Maximilian, Verse, Carlton Oldham, Roman Heckenberger, Astra Cry, Tomas, Anthony Dudden, Klaus, Jonathan Clark, Paul Mason, Atticus Porter, Michael Pace, Rufus, Zach Rogan, Ola Sten, and Josh Gadja. Thanks so much. So really kind of the next piece to talk about is the errata, which is something that is always going to happen in a game. And it really kind of ties to in what we talked about before the break. And again, we're not going to go through every single one of the erratas that are in there and the changes. But Matt, I'd like to get an idea, again, as we've been talking about, what was the overall kind of philosophy going into this first errata? What did you guys set yourself as goals?
So primarily when we look at when we looked at this errata, it was what are things that are awful to play against, not necessarily like broken or very powerful, but are just not fun to play against, because we find that like if you're playing, you're going to have fun if you're doing well. If you're losing, anything can make that game really unfun. And so trying to adjust things that are just awful to interact with, that was a primary goal. One of the other primary goals is if something is showing up all the time and it's not necessarily versatile, and even versatile models that are showing up all the time, that is not a good thing, because you want to be able to say like, and you want to see different things throughout each game, and each faction has a plethora of different things they can take, and making sure that one thing doesn't outshine the others, even if it's versatile. So like the first thing that we kind of adjust, like even an Arcanist, like Soulstone Miners, they got adjusted. Like they're versatile. They show up in every list, but people didn't enjoy playing against them. However much you enjoyed playing as them, they're fine. Like, I don't think they're like super fun to play as, but it was awful to just be like, cool, he's just going to sit underground, pop up and score points.
Yeah.
And that was changed in a plethora of way of like, gaining rounds one, it's not as easy to just show up and score points in strategies and schemes in general. But it's also saying, like, what can we take from this model that isn't necessarily removing how it works, but making it not as much as like a cherry on top, where some things are like, this doesn't need this thing to be super amazing at what it's doing. It always kind of felt extra.
Yep.
And that was a primary goal of making things feel as best as possible. And then there's always the, we need to buff some things so that they see play, especially if they're new and exciting, like Order Initiates. They got a cost reduced so that Marcus can have a bit more fun with them. And they're brand new, and we want people to experience them. So
I was a huge fan of that, because I think of all the new sculpts I've seen, those three models are three of my favorites.
Oh yeah, Bird Lady is amazing.
Oh yeah, and the Rhino guy. I'm going to deny that I like any Arcanist model, but those are good sculpts. Those are good sculpts.
Craig, we know that you're an Arcanist fanboy deep inside.
you want to hear like a dirty secret? I just picked up a Colette commission. That's. You want to talk about how good that box is? It's so good that even I was willing to paint it. And I picked up the commission for the main reason of the fact that I knew I would never buy that box, but I still wanted to paint it.
New Colette is really, really nice.
God, I'm
only
work.
Slightly sad that I personally own like Mr. Cooper, and I was like, I'll never need to buy that Colette, but I still want it.
Well, that Cooper crew is the, actually I own the Cooper crew. I love that crew.
Cooper's great.
Yeah, very good. So, Kyle, let's start a little bit with some of the erratas that you put into the core book. I'd be curious to know what you think were some significant things that really affected the core rules.
A big yet small. It looks like a big change, but really it's just a cleanup or the replace changes. It's essentially just a cleanup, but we did have to rewrite the section in a way. But all we were trying to do is address some of the outliers, and now it works as intended. That's one of the big ones, as far as the core rules, are concerned. We just wanted to make sure that, as Matt just said, you know, the experience is fun for both players and it makes sense. Players weren't getting into rules disputes instead of actually experiencing the game.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And another one that I happened to notice too was the actions generated by charge. I think the clarification there was key.
Yeah, just saying that like if charge is a trigger that you get, and so like Marcus generating his charge, it's still an action generated by a trigger, and we didn't want to say that like, oh, here's this one super specific exception. And that was really like a core fundamental of just being like, yeah, some of these things are obnoxious to play against when you're just like, oh, here's this model that's attacking you and then generating a charge which attacks you, and that generates an attack.
Yeah.
You're like, cool, that was one action. It was just just too much. And so saying like, yeah, we're gonna pull that back and make sure that like this is a bit more clarified, even if we have to say that, like, yep, that being generated by a trigger carries to an extent of just saying, yep, it's all subsequent actions generated by that trigger. Was really important to just making it feel better and not that really minute case that's awful.
Yeah, no, I agree. Kyle, is there a certain thing that people are going to see in the RADA that you consider yourself a champion of? Is there something that you thought really needed attention and people are going to see that in the RADA?
Well, I mean, a little bit of everything is a collaboration in the office. I wouldn't say that there's anything specifically that I championed. I did want to make sure that we touched Dashiell's summoning, and Matt had a really smart approach about that. Dashiell was having a little bit of difficulty getting the job done comparatively to other summoners, but we still like how he was doing it. So we made it a little bit easier for guards. We see totems as an extension of masters, and just sometimes it's better to make an adjustment on them than on the master itself. And I think Matt's approach to it worked out really well for that.
Yeah, I think that was a problem, and I really, really like the approach to the fix. Matt and Bayou, is there anything that you think definitely needed attention and got it?
12 cups of coffee.
Yeah.
God bless you.
Yeah.
This was primarily like diversion and marked territory. Those are good. Those are very powerful in our minds. Twitchy was in a place that it was very good for no reason and took forever to play.
Yep.
And was just like, why are you moving so much? And also, how does this make sense with what Twitchy, like, how does Twitchy make sense with what's actually happening? And so adjusting it to saying, like, yeah, when someone gets near you, you freak out a bit and back up. That is, it's way more reasonable because now it's way more of a defensive ability instead of just being like, turn one, I'm 17 inches up the board with almost nothing cost or however far. It lets it act more as what's intended and not be awful to play against and take 5 minutes of here's a 1-inch push.
Yeah, that's a big thing about the change to Twitchy is the whole concept slowed the whole game down. Those constant tiny interactions that it wasn't worth what it was actually accomplishing. I think we hit a sweet spot with that one as well.
I agree. Kyle, I was curious to know about the change to Bayou Smuggler. That's a model that I wasn't hearing a whole lot about, but you definitely made some changes to it. Why Bayou Smuggler and why those changes?
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. You weren't hearing anything about them. And we, just like you like the Order Initiates, we love the Bayou Smuggler models. A guy with an alligator on his back is just, I want to see that on the table. And we weren't seeing it in the Bayou. We weren't seeing it in Parker lists, and we wanted to make sure that we adjusted it. That one got a little bit of love. We want to see it on the table, and I think we hit a good spot with that one, too.
I agree. And the character in those sculpts again are fantastic. Matt, how about Guild? What got attention in Guild and why?
We already talked about the Dispatcher.
Yep.
Agent 46 is something that everyone kind of thinks about it, but Guild could use some love, and giving a nerf to Guild is not something that I liked doing. But yeah. The Agent 46 was unfortunate in how he was kind of working for and against the Guild, of saying like, I can mimic anything and you can't cheat it, was really hard to make things work in Guild properly. And it was one of those things that, like, while he's super good and Guild love needing their help, like, we think Guild are amazing, but it is something that we definitely felt like we needed to touch because of how unfun it was to play against. And also it warped what we could really do with the rest of Guild. And so just saying like, you can do this or you can do your mimic, one or the other, it made it a more of a choice and let him play his role properly of like, I'm going to be my assassin-y self, or I'm just going to take whatever you are. And that person is not necessarily the assassin.
Yeah, I agree. And I got to tell you, I've talked to some of the dedicated Guild players, and a term that was being used was the Agent 46 tax, which is in some ways they felt that the way Agent 46 worked out of the gate was hurting the faction because it limited what you guys could allow and what changes you could make. So I think in the long run, even though technically you're right, it's a nerf for 46, I think it's going to potentially free up Guild a lot more. How about Pale Rider, Kyle? What happened there?
So first we looked at writers as a whole, wondered if, they were creating kind of a black hole, but really we ended up focusing on Pale Rider, seeing it in, as Matt already kind of touched upon, models in every list, sometimes, guild players were putting, you know, Pale Rider on the table before they were choosing their master. And we don't want that. I don't think that, the approach is too heavy. We're still going to see Pale Rider on the table. But now again, it's a choice. And I think that's going to be, a major aspect that we want to hit with versatile models as a whole.
Well, and I tell you, we could say it on every one of these things, where things got a little bit of attention is, you know, it was also creating a really sucky experience as the opponent. So I think that, this will not only, you know, allow other models to come in outside of the Pale Rider, but it also makes the Pale Rider not just awful to play against. Right. So I really was very, I thought it was very even handed. And again, I think ultimately would be better for the faction. The other one that I just want to quickly point out, Matt, is No Prisoners. Can you kind of walk us through what happened there?
Yeah. So, No Prisoners originally, when we put it out, it was adding like a grenade action and, these other things. We didn't feel like it was really promoting what we wanted in Guild, or really adding that much to the faction. It was being seen sometimes, but like Leadline Coat is very good, just giving that straight armor. But what really wasn't there, and we wanted to give Guild the way to have a bit more freedom in how they're moving around the table. Guild is not exceptionally fast, and so giving them something that's saying like, I'm going to ignore blast damage and hazardous, and being able to walk around is very, very helpful of just being like, I can put this on my guys and not have to worry about them dying to just Karis all the time or dying to all these other things. And then also the new ability that we put on there, what is it? Get them in? What's the name of the ability? Catch them. That's what it is. That just giving Guild the ability to say like, we're primarily a gun faction. We do have some strong beaters, and getting them into place is going to help us even more. And it also, because it's that place effect, it lets them equally get over those hazardous terrain and all those walls that you really need to get over for. So if you're playing as like marshals and you bring Lady Justice, you can make sure she gets in and just swings her greatsword with her out without the charge to do as much impact as possible.
Yeah, and I got to tell you that it's going to take a little while, I think, for everybody to digest what we saw happen in this errata, because it's multi-layered. The more I've read it, the more I've digested it, the more I realize it's not as obvious what you guys were doing. And it'll be very interesting to see how it shakes out and how the initial hot takes will be different from where everybody settles. Kyle, let's talk about Neverborn. There's one model in particular in Neverborn that got some attention.
No, Stitch Together was perfectly fine. We didn't think that it was causing any problems.
Nobody's talked about it on a podcast or anything.
Right. All I'll really say is that we touched Stitch Together to make sure that, again, we're hitting into negative player experience territory.
Yeah.
Now it's still a worthwhile model of putting on the table, but you're not going to auto quit on the other side of the table when you see a few on the table either. So.
And I got to tell you, the light touch in general, I was really happy to see from you guys on this first errata. I don't feel like you nerfed anything into the ground. Now, everybody's going to say you did. That's going to be the initial hot takes on some of the stuff. But I think as it plays out, people will agree that didn't happen. Matt, I saw Inhuman Reflexes got some attention.
Yeah. So Inhuman Reflexes, like Butterfly Jump, is really good. And we didn't want to just adjust butterfly jump across the board, because like I said, that's adjusting a lot of models, and we didn't need feel like it was super necessary for what Inhuman Reflexes was doing. But we did want that movement, especially being able to get in and out of combat. But with how it is right now, giving your opponent more of the choice, like Neverborn are very aggressive, so your opponent can essentially say, I'm going to keep you in combat, or I'm going to keep myself alive,
yep,
gives the Neverborn player an equal amount of like being able to play and properly feel good about themselves. But it having a choice is always going to make you feel a little bit better, because you can always think, well, had I done it slightly differently, would it have been better? And it's not as negative of experience. So that was the primary thought process. I do want to touch on Stitch Together for a second, and that I remember my first official tournament in M3E was a Henchman Hardcore tournament. And I was playing my Outcast, and I fought against Hinamatsu and three Stitch Togethers. And that was the worst fucking game I've ever played.
Terrible.
I got so obnoxiously trounced, and I was like, I could have done nothing better.
Right. Well, and that's the big thing, Matt, is that I'm really good at getting trounced, right? I've made a career out of it. But what I don't like is getting trounced and 2 days later still thinking, you know what? There's nothing I could have done. You know, I don't mind getting trounced and, you know, on the drive home going, wow, I could have played that better. That would have changed. You know, this was a bad choice that I made here and stuff like that. But I think with Stitch Together, it was just too often you were like, well, I sometimes it felt like Stitch Together is you weren't even playing, that it was just the Dreamer player, whoever brought the Stitch, that they were playing their own little mini game, putting cards away and putting cards back. And, you know, you were there as a prop in order for the Stitch Together to do its thing. So I think I like the decisions
and
there.
And some of that is still core to how Stitch Together worked. It is fun to do that as Stitch Together and that player. It's not fun when you're just like, cool, my opponent can't do anything about it. At least now you can like cheat and defend yourself and that kind of
exactly
thing. And those flips are like, they suffer from accuracy now, which is a huge change of like, I'm not necessarily just going to be hit for 5 points of damage because that was the top card of the deck or whatever. Granted, you can still cheat, but if the Stitch Together fails, you can probably equally cheat, provided you're not on that negative yourself if you only barely won. So it's just making him more fun to play against in every way. And I know that's a lot about Stitch Together, but it's a big change. And
It is a big change. And to the point that both you and Kyle made, it's not going to stop that model from seeing the table, which makes me happy too. As much as I hate that effing model, I did not want to be in a situation where it was gone forever. Now, speaking of hating models, Kyle, talk to me about Rusty Alice.
So this one, I think the community's the gut reaction is going to be that this is too big of a nerf on paper, but the reasoning behind it makes a lot of sense. It's a necessary change, and all we did was adjust her movement. Disengaging to potentially deal 6 damage, no way to stop it, was a bit much. She's still super powerful, but now players will have ways of dealing with her.
Yeah, it lets engaging her actually stop her from playing.
Right.
Potentially, she can still get up with.
And that was the issue, guys. And I was like super proud of you. Super proud of you.
Yeah, I would love to just be like, she's stat 2 minimum on her gun and has no rapid fire. Just nerf her to the ground. But I don't play her, so whatever.
No, it was the disengage problem, right? Because if you've got somebody who is that good of a ranged threat, if you don't have a way to say, look, I need to deal with Rusty, you need to engage her. Well, that didn't mean anything before, and now it does. So I'm glad. How about Kyle, what happened with Benny?
So we've been talking about a lot of nerfs, but Benny got some love. So we wanted to throw a bone to Hamlin players. Maybe this time it's a plague infested one, but and we also wanted to make sure that he was fitting into Bandit Crews every once in a while too. So now he's going to be doing a little bit more on the table. He's going to he fills a role finally. I'm happy with where we landed on Benny as a whole.
Yeah, I think Benny now is a little bit more aligned to the changes that Hamlin made from 2 to 3,
right?
Which I think was which was quite frankly needed because he just didn't seem to fit anymore. Yet another cool sculpt and a thematic model that I'm really hoping will now see the table more. So, Kyle, another I thought interesting change was that within family, there was a model that got some attention.
Yeah. So earlier you had talked about dead schemes. And one thing we definitely don't want are dead models, particularly dead totems. And that was a phrase that was tossed around fairly often with the enslaved Nephilim. That was one thing that I really did not love seeing. We know that Perdita's crew is a little bit card hungry, so now the enslaved Nephilim has Nefarious Pact. It was in theme for it, and it also just is kind of a soft buff, and the crew will feel a fairly significant impact from that, I feel.
Well, and I love the fact that really, family and guard as keywords got some nice love just by making some small changes to the totems. And I love that, again, that approach, I think was a great one. Guys, we're going to take one last break. We're going to talk about probably the two factions that get yapped about the most, or at least some of the models that do. So let's talk about Resurrectionists and Ten Thunders when we get back from the break. Howdy folks, Craig here. Now if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with two measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast. So let's talk about two more factions. And then I want to stop talking about yesterday and today and start talking about tomorrow. But we do need to talk about what happened in Rezzers. So Matt, who got attention in Rezzers?
So yeah, the first big thing that we want to address was Archie. He's a big boy. We love Archie, and he's got a nice new hat, but that hat sometimes just showed up too much. And so we really wanted to make sure that he had a primary role that wasn't, I'm going to kill everything and also be everywhere and make Molly just scheme all the time because all the Krooligans jump to me, all these things. And so giving him a bit more reliance on his attacking and like adding rush to him but reducing his move means he's actually a little bit faster when you're moving less on your turns. But if he is just moving, if he's just walking like normal, he can equally get the distance. But his primary changes were just to make him feel like he is a beater, but he's not perfect. Archie is not all about like murdering children. He's a gentle giant in a way. he's granted, like, he's like Frankenstein's monster. He doesn't want to murder everything. And Ruthless felt really weird on his card because of that.
Yeah.
And so the idea of saying that, like, yeah, sometimes Archie being the resurrection or being the undead creature that gets scared is weirdly makes sense the most to us. And it gives him a distinct role in the faction of just being like, I can't deal with everything. Granted, he has his new action, Mournful Memories, that helps just a little bit. So he can kind of always get that extra thing, but that's helpful in all situations, especially when he's not trying to leap. It just gives him more of this, like, he's primarily fighting people, but he does have a weakness. Granted, Resurrectionists can just slap Ruthless on him just, with one of their upgrades, but if you super need that, you still absolutely can.
Yep.
But
and you can pay for it.
Yeah, you could pay for it. And
yep.
Right now it was primarily about it making him feel like what his cost says he should feel like, and saying he's going to kill things for Molly. He's not necessarily going to be killing things for everyone because his resources are a bit more intensive.
Yeah, and I like that because he's in a keyword that can handle a little bit more card intensity. Molly has ways to mitigate, you know, card hungry models. I have not played this version of Archie yet, but I got it as somebody who loves Archie. I did not see it nerfed to the table. Now, my opinion might change when I get my ass handed to me when I'm playing Molly, but
Archie's not going to do the same thing as he was before.
Yeah,
you do have to play him with a bit more finesse. He's not just going to be leaping into combat and punching you three times.
Right.
So.
And then being healed up six points and then, you know, rinse and repeat.
Leaping to a scheme later. Yeah.
Yeah. So Kyle, I've got what I think had to have been one of the tougher ones is what did you guys do in 10 Thunders?
We just left them. They're perfectly fine. We didn't see any feedback on them at all.
None at all.
So 10 Thunders clearly got some attention. We did touch a fair amount of models. We didn't go severely, though. Monaco Ray got touched a little bit. Yasunori got touched. Essentially, the approach is, the mantra of negative play experiences and making sure that those sort of things were mitigated. We want Yasunori still on the table, but we don't want to see it 100% of the time. Some things were breaking in areas that we, maybe didn't really consider, like Chiaki. Split the Soul was, very, very good. We are okay with power, but we do want power to be controlled. You'll see that adjustment there. That doesn't mean that Yan Lo is suddenly, not a master worth putting on the table, by any means. You're still going to see plenty of Yan Lo. It's just now that players can actually deal with it.
No, I completely agree. And I think actually the Chiaki change was nice because it promotes the keyword system even more,
right.
Which is something that I am totally okay with. So before we kind of transition into talking about some things coming up, the one thing that I know everybody listening is asking is, okay, great. You made changes to X number of models. How do I get the cards? When can we see these cards available?
Right. So what we're going to be doing is releasing a Gaining Grounds / Errata pack. It's going to be a one print only sort of thing. So do make sure to get your hands on it. And the reason behind it is because Gaining Grounds is a seasonal thing. It will not be forever around. Worst case scenario, if you can't get your hands on it, that's okay. It's going to be on drive-through. It's going to be on our app. Once we go live with Errata and Gaining Grounds, it'll just be a handful of days before it hits the crew builder. Those are the main three ways that you'll be able to get a hold of this.
That's great. So Matt, talk to me about tomorrow. What are some things that we can talk about maybe people don't know about yet?
There's this one thing that we've been working on, but I don't know if anyone really knows about it. Some might say it's like an eighth faction, but I don't know. Right now it's like two masters. To get to the point, we're working on Explore Society. We're super excited about it. There's a lot of stuff coming. We've shown off some of it.
The art looks great.
Yeah. We've shown off a bit of Cooper. We've shown off some of his Apex models. We've shown off the Brock Inspector and a little bit of that keyword with the Deva. And we're super excited for all of these things to come out and talk about them.
I bet. Kyle, it's hard. It's got to be hard as a designer to figure out what a new faction's going to do, feel, and look like. And I don't expect you to, tell us that about Explorers, but I would be curious to know, what do you do when you say, okay, we need a new faction or we're going to add a faction? What does that process even look like at a high level?
Well, it's different for designing the Explorer Society than, say, designing the Bayou, for example. The Bayou is very environmentally based, location based, and gremlin based. The Explorer Society is very different. They've been a part of our world since first edition. So if you dig enough into our lore, you'll find that Lord Justin Cooper has existed this whole time. What I will say about the Explorer Society is, starting off, I love the speculation threads on the forums in a weird place. I get a real kick out of the stuff. Ultimately, though, this faction is really going to surprise you. The characters in it are diverse mechanically and thematically. Like I just said, some have been a part of our lore since first edition. Some have been in Chronicle stories. Some have been hinted at in third edition stories. Others are brand new. They're going to be like a brick to the face and surprise. You will not expect them. Even the stuff that we've revealed, there's loads of surprises. The Deva and Brock inspectors, they might seem one way, but you know, there's more behind that story. Justin Cooper, even, you know, like he was a part of, first edition content. But it's been a long time since he's been walking around. There's a lot of things that can happen in Malifaux in between that time. A lot of new things for him to hunt. Essentially, I mean, I guess we could dip a little bit into his mechanics. Is that if you didn't already get the hint from the contract that you signed, he will very much feel like he is hunting you down.
Nice.
And we're gonna his crew as a whole is gonna cover the safari hunting classic stuff that you might be aware with the Explorer Society as a whole.
Yeah, and the sculpt screamed that, which is really, really exciting. And Matt, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this, and you may not be able to answer this, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. Are we going to see Explorer Society trickle out, or is there going to be a ta-da, here's the Explorer Society?
You're right. I cannot answer my question.
Okay.
but I will say, Cooper, we're really excited about him. We hope that with everything else that we talked about today, thematically and how keywords work, Cooper has some exciting stuff. You should feel like when you're playing him, like you're on the hunt, and when you're playing against him, like you're being hunted.
That's awesome.
You're going to see a lot of cool things coming out of him and all the rest of Explore Society. Kyle mentioned earlier, but if you think you know what you're going to see, you're dead wrong. These guys, they are not the stereotype that you necessarily think there are. There's secrets and things hidden within the Explore Society that we're really, really excited to show in the future.
Wow, that's even fluffy sounding. That's great. Well, gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for coming on. I've been super excited since you guys reached out, and I am really anxious to play these changes and to play these new schemes and strategies and get a feel for really the impact on the game. And I've said it a few times, listeners, make sure you give it some time. You know, remember what it was like playing your first third edition game versus the games you've been playing now and how your thoughts have changed on it. Kyle, I hope to have you on again. Matt, we're good. I think two episodes is probably enough. No, I'm going to talk you both into coming on again. Any kind of shout outs or plugs that we want to get out there?
A shout out to Matt in the office, our other designer, for being the voice of reason.
Well, and before we started recording, Kyle, you and I already talked about getting Matt on the show for a very specific reason. So I'm really anxious to get Matt on the show.
Craig, I want to give a shout out to you at Third Floor Wars and all the other podcasts. You guys are all amazing. I listen to them. We listen to them all the time.
We listen to you guys. So we hear you. The good and bad. We hear it all.
Super exciting to see you guys as a community. And we're really happy with everything you guys are doing. And
I'm glad.
Honestly, it means a lot to us. And it helps us helps us out more than you would know. So.
Oh, good, 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 good. Yeah. There's, you know, obviously Kyle and Schemes and Stones is great, and Doug's, Scoundrels, I'm a huge fan of. We're starting to see some new, podcasts, coming out. I've had a couple people reach out to me for advice, on starting a Malifaux podcast. And my advice has been start recording, get it out there.
I will say, if you put out a podcast with one episode, I'll probably still listen to that episode.
Yeah, it's part of what makes the community grow is content, and you know, it's YouTube channels, it's things like that. I was glad to see TNG start doing some Malifaux, and we're starting to see Malifaux coming out of Ash and Gorilla miniatures and stuff, and that those are all very good signs about the growth of this game. And I know my listeners are passionate about the game. And, you know, having it grow and seeing that start to happen is great. Well, guys, we will talk soon. Make sure you put on your shields and your helmets and things like that when all of this drops.
I haven't taken it off since the release.
All right. And for those of you that stuck around to the end, I appreciate you listening. Take care.
Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest gaming apparel and gear. While you're there, check out how the USFO Tour is shaping up. How does your conference compare to the others in the United States? Where do you rank nationally? Get those models built, painted, and on the table so we can see you at the US Masters Invitational in October of 2020. Also, rate and write a review on this podcast for us. It really helps us find people almost as cool as you are. Thanks for listening. Howdy, friend. Craig here. Is this episode making you realize you need to buy some models? Gadzooks Gaming is my favorite online retailer because of their large selection, killer prices, and great customer service. Don't you hate buying an entire crew box when you only need one model? Gadzooks sells crew box models individually and saves you a ton of money. They even have free shipping to the US and Canada if you spend $100 or more. Swing by GadzooksGaming.com and make sure you tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. All the details are in the show notes.
All right. I'll bring us back from the break.
Small change on what? The dispatcher, eight things changed on this card.
Well, you know what I meant. All right. All right.
I want everyone to know that I was getting mauled by a cat during that conversation.
Now so brave.
I'm a little worried that guild players are going to sound, because we didn't talk about enslaved Nephilim or frontiersmen. And those are significant buffs.
They're not huge, but they are helpful. They're just
right. We're going to see Bass on the table now. We're going to see Perdita on the table now.
Well, here, Kyle, I'm going to set you up, Kyle, and then I'll edit it in. Okay.
Sure.
I was just going to say, if we wanted to talk about frontiersmen later, like we'll talk about the Explorer Society. We could also bring them up then.
Sure.
Or we can just talk about it now.
Well, let's talk. Let me tee up the enslaved Nephilim. Because I think that's one worth calling out, Kyle. So I'll lead you in, and then we'll talk about it, and then we'll come back to talk about Rezzers. Okay.
Sure.
All right. This is the part where I'm going to keep my mouth shut the most.
Kyle, I hope you're okay with me just being like, "Yeah, we yell at each other."
It does happen, but I mean, Every time that does happen, it is infrequent. It's not really actually yelling. It's we're both passionate about ideas.
And I would think, just
like Matt said, sometimes it takes sleeping on it, and really thinking about the stuff and thinking about the approach the other person had and that sort of stuff.
I'll tell you right now, if you'd not said that, people would think you guys were sugarcoating it. Everybody knows that you have to have those times where you guys are going like that, or you're just not telling the whole story.
That corrupted the last conversation. Not a great day at the office.
That's really funny. That's really funny. All right. I'll bring us back. All right. Good segment, guys.
Greg, I just laugh because you asked Kyle that question. I was like, I don't know if he's trying to get us to talk about Hidden Martyrs with this question, but I will if Kyle doesn't.
No, to be honest with you guys, I thought this was going to be a lot harder than it is, because I part of me wants to point you in the right direction, but a big part of me doesn't. But at the same time, it's part of my job is to help give you guys things to talk about.
There are things we want to talk about. We'll make sure we hit them.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Well, I hope so. Kyle might.
We're figuring it out.
And so pushing the idea of the killing bigger things is important. And so if we want to what was I talking about? I just completely lost my brain. Yep. Public Enemies is about killing things smartly.
So here, let's I'm gonna give you a place to start from.
Kyle, do you want to talk about Public Enemies?
Sure. do we need an intro question?
No, you just get started, Kyle, and I'll make it sound so good when I edit this. Well done, guys. Except my fucking webcam. My webcam's like, Jesus Christ, you are an ugly son of a bitch. I can't look at you in focus. I'm going to take just a second.
I will say I enjoyed, hey, Matt, talk about the easy strategy of kill things. Just blank.
I don't know, Matt, if you ever listened to the very, very end of the episodes, but I put out. Yeah. And outtakes in there. You don't know how many times you just completely lose track of what the hell you're talking about. It's just so easy to do. And it's, I'm trying to get better as a host at, you know, getting people to forget they're on a podcast. Because I think that's what it is you're so self-conscious about what you're saying that you just kind of lose track of shit. You get too far ahead of yourself.
Yeah. And specifically for Public Enemies, I was just like, okay, I want to talk about this one thing. How do I get from point A to point B?
Yeah.
Just could not find it.
That's funny. That's funny.
So,
all right. So Kyle, we'll probably launch with you. Let's talk, we'll talk big at first, kind of what we have here. So kind of what was the thinking before you created any new schemes or changed any schemes? What was everybody sitting down and saying, guys, let's put together design goals for Gaining Grounds 1. Does that sound good?
Sure.
Cool.
Now or?
No, I'll bring us back. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Now, Kyle. Jesus Christ, Kyle. Act like you've been on a podcast
Come
before.
On. Shit together.
I've already got enough to deal with when I got Matt. I don't need both of them. Right? All right. So, all right. That didn't happen.
You all right?
Yeah.
You want to take a second?
Yeah. I just had a stroke. No big deal.
Okay.
Real funny. Laugh at my stroke. I'm trying to think of how I want to bring this back. So
Kyle, maybe you should leave the podcast,
Kyle. I got it.